Hey, welcome, welcome,
welcome,
welcome to the Marshaverse. This is a place in the rest of the universe where I come to make shit make sense. Marcia.
From the entertainment capital of the world, Las Vegas, Nevada, it's midnight in the Marshaverse, starring Marcia Warfield and her two sons, Stephen Roberts and Gills Hudson, as the problem guy.
Good morning. Welcome to Midnight in the Marshaverse, the witching hour where yesterday becomes tomorrow. But right there in the center of that transition is magic. It's the magic time when the portals open and the spirits are free. And so we like to get together once a week, have some conversation, have a little cannabis and cognac. Because we need to woosah, we need to relax, we need to take a step back and consider and not just react and rush to the next thing. So we're going to have, I'm going to be having a little Courvoisier and my special guest this week. I'm so excited. I'm so excited about all our guests. You know, I appreciate so much that people will stay up late and hang out with me against the grain. You know, this is not the normal time when people do podcasts and webcasts, and which is why it's attractive to me. I've been a night owl my whole life. It's one of the reasons I do stand-up comedy. And so I wanted to enjoy that feeling of freedom that you get in the nighttime when everybody's asleep. It's also, you know, really cool. And I've been looking into some history of the significance of midnight in history, especially in Black American history. It's been fascinating. I'll be doing a series on that to share that information because it's just special. But before we get into all of that, and I introduced my guest, somebody I've known since we were children starting out in this game. And so we have a lot of ground to cover. I'm not going to fuck around like I usually do and try to explain the world in my own terms. But before we get to that, I want to have my refreshment. And please feel free to join me. Have some milk and cookies, a spam sandwich, or, you know, run to the store and, you know, get a burger. I don't care. Or if you want to have a little libation, feel free. This is Courvoisier VSOP. We're going to pour a little baby shot. Not too much because, you know, the problem with drinking and smoking when you get old is you don't know if you're stoned or experience the onset of dementia. And so I don't want to get too loopy before we get started. So here we go. Just a touch. And I always drink it with a little soda back because I don't really like the effects of sweet drinks fermenting in your gut overnight. It's not fun. But I did want to ask you, if you're watching the show, you know, I sometimes switch up and have some kind of mixed drink. If you have a favorite mixed drink made with cognac, let me know. Send me a comment and tell me how to make it, and I'll try it. You know, we'll name it after you. It'll be Debbie's potion. The hell. Smoking. Tonight, we have our church vape with a church cartridge. And this is a sativa called Banana Split. I don't know. That's all I know. So I'm going to take a little sip because I don't want to get too dementia. I'm so glad it doesn't taste like banana splits. I don't like weed that tastes like candy and stuff, but that don't make no sense. But be that as it may, when we started in stand-up in the mid-70s, I don't think any of us could have imagined that the clubs would become what they've become, that cable would become what it became and morph into streaming and what we have now. Back then, we didn't have cable channels. We had HBO and Showtime, but they were separate entities, and you had to, you know, buy a special box for each one or choose which one you wanted. And the guys who were ended up being, you know, the head honchos of those streaming services used to hang out at the Improv and the Comedy Store just like we did. We wanted to open for singers. We wanted to participate in a different kind of show business, the one we grew up with the variety shows and the Tonight Show and the Ed Sullivan Show and movies. But right at that time, the studio system died. Independent films like Blaxploitation and the karate movies and stuff, that started taking over. Cable started growing, and the clubs had a life of their own, and they started franchising, and they started opening up clubs around the country. You could make a living after the comedians demanded so, because at first, we couldn't pay rent. We couldn't make a living doing stand-up. And my guest, we're going to get right into it. My guest was there in the beginning. And the women who did stand-up at that time were few and far between. And for Black women, I knew of a young lady named Brenda Verrett. And there was another Roberta Perrell. And Shirley Hemphill. Shirley had just gotten on What's Happening. And What's Happening was in the midst of a whole brouhaha with Eric Monte, who was writing, who had just finished Cooley High, and who was had written for Sanford and Son and All in the Family and Good Times. That was his show, Good Times. But he was embroiled in a big lawsuit with Norman Lear about ownership and all that kind of stuff. But at that time, Shirley was a breakout. She was one of the first breakout comedians and the first breakout comedian that I knew. But Shirley did, she was Southern. She did a Southern kind of charm stand-up that was very funny, but it was more in the tradition of women who did stand-up who had a character of sorts, or who did self-deprecating. I don't know that Shirley did that, but you know, a lot of the women who did stand up put themselves down. Many of them had invented husbands or boyfriends to empower them. And the only woman I had seen who didn't do that, who basically did stand up monologies, grab the mic, state your opinion as if you have a right to have it, was my next guest. And I didn't meet her until 1976, 77. But I believe she started a few years before that. And she's going to tell us all about it and her illustrious career and what she's doing now. But I want you to say hello to my friend Elaine Boozler.
Hey.
Hey. How are you?
I'm fine. Man, I loved Shirley. She was so funny. When I love an act, I know it instantly. So yes. She had a joke that used to slay me. She said, well, they took me to Chasen's for, you know, the big producers took me to Chasen's for dinner. Now, mind you, this is 50 years ago. So yes. A $20 bowl of chili would today be a $200 bowl of chili. So just keep that in mind. She said, and they made me get the chili, and I got the chili, and they said, eat it up. You know, that's $20, that chili. And I said, $20 for a bowl of chili? Eat up, child. There must be a diamond in the bottom of this bowl.
Yes, I remember Shirley. Shirley was also very kind, you know, and she helped me out a lot. She gave me a TV. I had to get another TV to put on top of it to get the sound, but she gave me a TV.
She bought a big mansion. I think it belonged to someone from Kiss or some early rock and roller. And she said, And I'm a swimmer. I've been swimming a mile a day for 40 years. And she said, oh man, it has this Olympic pool. I said, oh, well, I'm so glad we're friends. And she said, no, I'm going to fill it in. I can't swim. I said, oh, you're going to swim. I'm coming over there and you're going to swim.
Did she swim?
No.
Okay. Well, no, she's playing tennis.
Yeah. But you know. I would walk down the street with her in New York and we'd be going to lunch and it would be midnight. Because she stopped for everyone,
right?
Everyone. And, you know, she's so recognizable. It's not someone who can just, you know, walk along. I mean, she was so physically recognizable and she would stop and talk to anyone forever. And this happened a million times. They go, I'm going to go eat. And I'd just walk away and go get my lunch.
Never I would want me to bring you anything.
Yeah, exactly.
Too yeah, friendly. Well, you know, you had your time in that spotlight, but I want to go back to before I met you. You started in 1973?
Yeah, 73.
So take me back to 1973.
First of all, you know how many bottles of wine ago that was? Do you think I remember anything?
Who introduced me to Elaine in 1973?
Great. I was 20 years old. I was raised by the Taliban in Brooklyn. Literally everything the Taliban does to women was done to me. You know, no freedom, no talking, no dating, no, I knew nothing. I was taught nothing. Nothing was expected of me. My brother was the one who was given an education and a car and an allowance, and I was locked in a room. So when I got out of there, I was like a wild, feral animal. And all I wanted was I would live in a closet if I could just have a roof over my head away from those people. That was it. And I mean, I did every job you can imagine, you know, answering phones in massage parlors and, you know, waitressing and hostessing, I mean, anything. And when I ended up at the comedy club, it was only because I had been fired from every job in New York City. Literally, I was the worst waitress there ever was. The fastest I ever got fired as a waitress, I got hired in this place and they said, okay, we'll give you a chance. And so a guy ordered brandy. So the bartender gives me the big brandy snifter and I put a straw in it.
Oh.
I walk because I know nothing about life. And I'm walking past the maitre d' and I've been there for 5 minutes. He takes the straw out, throws it over his shoulder and says, you're fired. And me with my survival and my brain, I said, he asked for a straw. He said, get out. So, you know, when I backed into the improv, which was just a dying toilet in those days, it was nothing. I backed into that place as a waitress. There were days of the week, the clubs, there was Fridays and a Tuesdays and there was a Wednesdays. And, you know, if there were months, I would have been fired 12 more times. Backed into the improv as a waitress and, you know, just kept my head down trying to be a waitress. And, you know, it just started from there. But I mean,
how did you know you were funny? Were you like passing out drinks going, I can do better than this guy?
Oh, God, no. I was passing out drinks just praying that I had the drinks right because we paid for our mistakes and in more ways than one. And so,
you're fired.
Yeah.
You're fired.
Well, real bars have glasses that match the drink. You'd get Courvoisier in a, you know, in a right. snifter and a highball glass for a highball. But the improv was this cheap, just toilet. I'm not being disrespectful. It was at the end of a dark block next to Dyke's Lumber, which was everything was black at night, no lights, nothing. And you would run from the subway stop to get to the club, hoping that whoever was going to mug you would think, oh, someone has her already. Someone's going to get her already. I can't cut in there. So, and you'd go there and it was a dying thing. It wasn't a comedy club. It had been formed for Broadway singers and dancers to have a place to hang out after the shows. And so comedians were, you know, now and then, happenstance, whatever. Nothing was planned. There was no schedule or anything. And it was always pretty empty. It was just, I kept thinking it's going to close and I'll have to get fired from a new place. You know, it's just.
It sounds like the improv in L.A. Because back then on Melrose, nothing was open. There was nothing on Melrose when they first opened up. And it was like, that's where civilization stopped. And then it was the Melrose. And then they build it up again on the other side of Las Vegas.
Yeah.
Down there. I mean, but it was really nothing. It was dark. It was.
Absolutely.
Nobody
it was there. Store in the mall, you know, and civilization always stops when comics come around. So
how did you, what happened when you got on stage?
So first of all, I could sing. And so before that, when I was 17, I got out of Brooklyn at 14. I started working. I got out of there. And when I was 17, I got a job as a singer and a dancer in a review in the Bahamas. So I got to live in the Bahamas for it was insane. I was 17 years old. Dancing, and it was just crazy. And then they went on to do cruises from that, the Lucayan Beach Hotel. And they said, you're not attractive enough to come. And I said, oh, great. Okay, thank you. And so when I went to get the waitress job, I mean, this is how we, you know, had to cope in those days. I go in to get the waitress job. And of course, Bud Friedman was the worst hound dog who ever lived. You know, forget it. I mean, we didn't even have a word for sexual harassment in those days. We just called it going to work.
Yeah. I mean, it was Playboy Club.
Please. You know, I was in the Me One movement. That's how long ago this was. So he said, all right, you can start Monday. I said, oh, thank you. And he says, what'd you get fired from your last job for? And I said, oh, they said my nose was too big. And he says, your nose? I haven't even gotten past your tits yet. And I thought, oh, goody, a job. This was life, huh?
Yeah. So that was in New York.
Yeah, that
but
was in New York.
Bill hadn't opened the club in L.A.
No. And, okay. Yeah. So I was in New York and all the drinks were the same glass. There was no differentiation. It was a round 8 ounce of ball glass and you put a red straw in it. So you had to know what your drinks were because the glass would not tell you. And my first night there, I had people, they all ordered brown drinks. It was Tab, Coke, rum and Coke, Diet Coke, root beer. It was beyond belief. And of course, I was so intimidated just being in public because I had been under a bed for, 20 years that I just put all the drinks down and they were all wrong. And every drink was given to the wrong person. So I had to pick up all the drinks and you had to go to Silver, Bud's wife, and say, I made a mistake and I have to redo these drinks. And she would add up what you owed because you had to pay for the wrong drinks. And it was my first night. And I said, these are all wrong. She said, your whole station was wrong? I said, yes, they're all wrong. And she looks at me as the first thing she ever said to me, great teeth, but you're dumb. And I thought to myself, great teeth? Really? Really?
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. I was so lost.
It would have been great if you just said, it's mix and match night. Figure it out.
Yeah, I didn't have chops at the time. I had nothing. And so this is how I met the love of my life, Andy Kaufman. I went back to the bar and I gave them all the duplicates again, the papers to fill out the drinks from, your duplicate checks. And as I was going to serve the drinks again, still not knowing what I had, Andy was on stage. And he caught my eye and I caught his eye. And I was tasting the drinks behind the people because I had to know what I had. So I would taste the drink from the straw and go rum and Coke. And he's watching me in disbelief. We haven't met. And so he does the whole thing. We're going to look over here now. And he takes all their focus off of, me and makes them look on the other side of the room. And he saved my life.
Oh.
And then we went out that night and that was it. And I don't participate in all these horrible shows about him and books about him because they're all done by people who never met him and didn't know him and get it wrong. And I've stayed away from it. But after he died, I wrote a piece for Esquire, which is still the benchmark of reading about and knowing Andy Kaufman. It's on ElaineBoozler.com. And people read it and they still write to me and say, wow, I was never a fan of his. Now I love him. And you gave him to me without giving away his secrets. And so it's a beautiful piece. And that was my...
I'll have to check that out because my knowledge of Andy Kaufman was probably the same show I saw you on for the first time. I think I was still in Chicago and you were doing stand up. And I was like, yes, yes, finally, somebody who's not apologizing for being a girl doing stand up. And I think I had seen Andy on one of the variety shows or Saturday Night Live doing the Mighty Mouse thing. And I thought it was hysterical. And I loved the way he would stand on stage and not do anything and get laughs. And he just had a presence. And well, then I remember when he had a fight during the Comedy Store Marathon. Mitzi had decided to have a marathon in the main room after she took over the whole thing. And it's like the third day and people are crazy. Andy comes in with a woman and somebody else, I don't know who, and they get into a fight. They get into a big fight and their table's turning and and then he storms out. And it's probably the highlight of that event.
He was just the most fun you could have. And, I said what I had to say in that article and all these horrible books and these stupid, there's a couple of people who have made, Andy's gone 41 years this year. He's gone longer than he was here. And there are two people on this planet who have made their entire 41 year fortunes on Andy's death. And I have so less than zero respect for them. And it's a tragedy because they keep getting to tell their story, which is a lie. And it makes me sad. They just make money off him endlessly, the two of them. And, the movie Man in the Moon, they gave me the script. And I said, it's so wrong. You're doing such a disservice to him. So they pulled it away from me and made up this other love of his life who he knew for a year and happened to be around when he got sick. It was all fake. But anyway, that's movies. My husband managed the Doors for their entire, years that they were together. And then we watched the Oliver Stone movie and he went, well, I never met that guy. that's Jim.
Okay. Well, talking about stories that everybody has read that they get wrong. You and I were there when the comedians went on strike.
Yeah. That book got it completely wrong.
And what happened? How did that happen? And, like I said, I was there. But from your point of view, what happened?
Well, I was shocked that the book I'm Dying Up Here got it so completely wrong because he taped our interviews. So he should have gotten it completely right. Plus, he had been a newspaper reporter. So Diane Nichols, who I love and is a great comedian. We had a drinking game one night. We said, let's start at the beginning of the book and let's drink every time there's something wrong in it. And I'm not kidding you. By the end of chapter one, we were laying on my dining room floor. We could go no further. I mean, the telling thing, when they opened the LA Improv, Bud wanted a seasoned comedian who no one out here had seen yet. He brought me out for a month, put me up at the little place where you go for a night when you're divorced, put me up for a month so I would be every night headlining the brand new opened improv for a month. And literally the guy writes the book and he says, well, Elaine holds grudges and she has never set foot inside the LA Improv. And I went, I opened it 30 nights in a row and I was there for years. I mean, what are you writing? Anyway, the way it happened was this. We all worked for free. They kept telling us it was a college and this is where we're going to learn our craft. And of course, I hadn't been to college, actually hadn't been to high school. So I thought, this is great. I can go to college and I didn't go to high school. Here's the chance. So they kept saying it's a college and you can work on your stuff. And we bought it. We bought into that. Okay, there was no cover charge. People drank. That's fine. And then Mitzi bought the old Ciro's huge nightclub, which is now the main room of the Comedy Store, and attached it to the store and slapped a $10 cover charge on, which in those days would now be a $100 cover charge. Gas had just gone up to $1 a gallon, which was unbelievable for us. Mm-hmm. And she was getting $10 a head plus the drinks. And she said to us, you have to dress up if you want to work in the main room. You have to treat it like Las Vegas and no breaking in material there. This is professional. It's a show. And we said, and how much do we get paid? So when she said nothing, This is a college, but we have to dress up, not work on material. You're getting an amazing amount of money. You know, we're chewing gum off a shoe. What the hell? And so we had a meeting at my little house on Sweetser. I lived on Sweetser Avenue, and the meeting was Mooney and George Miller and Tom Dreesen, me. I'm trying to remember who else was there. And we decided we would go on strike. And it was 1980, and we started picketing the Comedy Store. We got a lot of press, and you know, no bucks, no yucks. We had all our signs and everything, and the strike went on for a long time. The upshot is that she settled on paying. You know, we never got back in there. We were punished, so we never got the fruits of our labor. But that's okay. But there are comedians now. They work the Comedy Store in the main room for a month. They got 10 grand in their pocket. They don't even know we did that. I remember I went to the Comedy Store a couple of years ago because I was going to do the Tonight Show with Fallon, and I wanted to break in stuff. And I went there, and it was all these comics I hadn't met. But, you know, they knew my work, and so it was very nice. And they said, yeah, but, you know, you guys, like, you left here, and, you know, we didn't even get paid when you left. I said, no, don't you know this story?
Yeah. No, they don't.
You no. got paid what you get paid because of us. One of us died. Steve Lubetkin died during yeah. that strike. It was so horrific. And right. you get 10 grand a month here because we stood out there for months and picketed and had nothing. And, you know, I just think I wish somebody would have written it right so they'd know.
Well, there's still time. But
you know how we did it for them? Mitzi initially offered to pay you and me and Dreesen and Mooney. She said, I'll pay the real headliners. Those other kids are still in college. And we said, no. We make money now. You don't even have to pay us. Pay them. They're starving.
They got to eat. People got to. Yeah. We couldn't pay rent. We couldn't do anything. We had other jobs. It was just not. It wasn't happening. And
I wanted,
She was buying property in Westwood. In La Jolla, in the most expensive places in Southern California.
Right,
and
which is great.
Buying up condos and stuff, and the comics are going to her, Mitzi, I can't pay my rent. Well, you can work the door.
Yeah.
This is not true.
Not for stand-up. My rent was $265 and I couldn't pay it, so insane. Right. I want to tell your fans about the time you and I did the Golden Gate Park carbo load before the Beta Breakers race. Do you remember it?
I remember the Beta Breakers because I didn't know what the hell it was at that time.
It's the funniest story in history.
What did I
do? Okay. So the Beta Breakers is I don't know if it's a 5K or a 7K or a 10K, but it's a big race. Everyone runs in costume and the money goes to charity. And the night before, the city sponsors a huge pasta feed. Big carbo loading the night before in Golden Gate Park. There are no fewer than 100,000 people in that park. It is beyond belief. And every year they have a huge music group entertain in the middle of all of it while everyone is running and it's daylight and it's kids and skateboards and carriages and roller skates and babies being born on the side of the stage. I mean, it's literally like the vortex of the universe there. Well, this particular year you had just gotten huge from Night Court. So you were a real get. So it was a mother and a daughter. It was the first time they were hired to book this. And instead of booking music, they booked you and me. And I thought to myself, they don't know what they're doing because they shouldn't be there. No one can, you know, there shouldn't be comedians up. It's light out. There's 100,000 people here eating, talking. They brought their own bands. People were playing guitar. People were making business deals. You can't imagine. And okay, so I was supposed to close. You were going to go on first. And I said, I knew it was wrong, but I also knew that they were paying us a ridiculous amount of money. So we said, yes, okay. Now, you know, because you're a real comedian with the soul of a comedian, you know, the worst thing you can say to any comedian before she goes
on. Don't do that.
That's right. Don't say something. I was about to step onto a theater one night, a gorgeous, beautiful theater in some city. I'm dressed to the teeth, you know, and 1 second before I'm about to go on, the, you know, button down woman comes up to me and she says, don't say fuck. And my husband said that he went, oh God. Oh, lady, what did you just do? And she said, what? He said, this is on you. This is on you. You know it, man. You cannot do that. You can't. We are born agitators. We are born rebels. Well, I'm in the hotel room enjoying the basket, whatever they left, and they both come in crying. Oh my God. Oh my God. Marcia's supposed to go on first. It's light out. There's families and kids. All we said to her was, please don't do the tongue up the ass joke. And now she said she's doing it. I said, why did you tell her not to do it? What's wrong with you people? She's a seasoned, brilliant comedian and a smart woman. She would have gotten on stage, looked out, seen kids and families, and not done the tongue up the ass joke. Now she has to do it because you said that. Well, what are we going to do? I said, I'll ask her. So I go find you. And I said, Marcia, you're not really going to do it, are you? And you said, oh, yeah. I said, look, we understand. I understand why you have to, but you know you can't. And you said, but I have to now.
I have to.
I said, I know, but they didn't mean it. It wasn't it wasn't disrespectful. They don't know better. And you said, I'm doing it. And I said, I gotcha. So I go back and they're crying their eyes out. They're going to kill us, the cities. I said, here's what we'll do. I'll go on first. And they said, what? I said, I'm going to go on and I'll do 2 hours because that's what I do, 2.5 in those days. I was 2.5. I said, I'll do 2 hours until it's dark and everyone's asleep and gone. You know, the kids will be asleep. People will be ready for a real show and Marcia will come on. And they said, you would do that? I said, yeah. So I said, hey, I'm going on first. You said, oh, great. So it's time to go on. It's broad daylight. They walk me and my boyfriend, Steve, at the time to the stage is like, someone threw a matchbook in the Pacific Ocean. That's how little. Like the stage is a matchbook. The ocean is around us. A billion people eating, drinking, throwing up, pooping, having baby, talking, scream. You can't, New Year's Eve at Times Square, nothing. And I put 1 foot up the first step and they're trying to introduce me. You can't hear anything. And my boyfriend says to me, he looks out at the crowd. He goes, oh, babe, what are you going to do? And I said, I don't know, but I know I'm opening with the tongue up the ass joke.
You got it.
And we both had great shows. We had a great time. I talked to everybody for 2 hours. They had the best time. Little kids running up, you know, talking, asking questions. At the time,
they weren't paying attention. No way. Plus, nobody could hear what we said. It was insane.
It went well. And then you really had a ready audience and you did a great show. I mean, those people had a great time, but I mean, don't tell a comedian, you just blew it. That's it. That's on you.
Okay. Before we go, before we bring out the guys who are, you know, champing at the bit and everything, you were on Night Court.
Yeah.
You did, you worked with Richard.
Bull.
Tell me about that experience.
You know I won't.
Come on. Really?
Are we supposed to talk ill about the dead? You know how he was to me.
He was that way to everyone. And, you know, we've protected him for, 30 years or so, where nobody ever said anything about Richard.
How mean he was.
Richard hated us. And when he would be asked about coming back to do Night Court again, he would go, hell no. I hate those people. I mean, he never
liked us. He didn't like anyone.
You had to work much closer with him than we usually did. You know, we
and you're a beautiful set of people that know each other and are comfortable.
It was a family. And he was that family member. Every family has one.
Well, that was my whole family originally, so it didn't bother me too much. But
it didn't bother me because I grew up similar to you. Yeah. But
we read our first scene, and he says out loud in front of everyone and the director, he goes, well, if she calls that acting, I'm not doing this with her. You call that acting, I'm not doing this with you. And I just waited for, you know, people to go, okay, let's do it again. I had nothing to say. You know, I wasn't going to open my eyes. There was nothing for me to do except be there. But did you like
how did you get through that?
you get through it because I grew up like that. I grew up with horrible, horrible people who did everything they could to make it terrible. So, you know, I wanted to say to him, oh, honey, you should be my mother. You're an amateur. You are an amateur. Have at it, baby. You'll never get to me. No, to me, it has nothing to do with me. It's all about him. It's his problem. What I did after the show, I don't know if you remember this, but you guys mm-hmm. always had a table read on Monday where, you know, where I'm gone now, my show taped. And now you all get together on Monday and read the new script together in a room. Well, I sent 36 long stem red roses to that room, to the table read, to him in front of everyone, had them delivered with a card that said, it was so wonderful to work with you. Thank you so much. Love, Elaine. And I asked you what his reaction was. And you said, oh man, he just looked down like he was so ashamed. And I thought, hey, mission accomplished.
Yeah, he didn't know how to take it. And we had similar reactions. We could talk all night because there's a lot of water.
I never sleep.
Under this bridge. When you went back out on tour, 10 years ago, you went back out on tour and I never stopped.
I mean, I was always
supposed to go out together. And what happened?
What, when we were in Vegas together? When you weren't working?
I wasn't working. So I came to see you in Vegas and I was totally, I had not worked in so long. I was totally out of element, had no really plans. You inspired me to start working again. Then later, we had talked about, because you and I had done shows together.
Yes, but you stood me up. You stood me up.
I didn't stand you up.
Yes, you did. I was working with Caroline Ray, and we had every meal together. I invited you to every meal, and we had dinner and lunch together all the days I was there. And you said, I don't know about getting back on stage. I don't know how you do that. And I just kept saying, you do it. You're the best. You'll do it. I said, you'll come to LA. You'll stay in my house. I have a car for you. I'll get you spots in all the places. You just, let's do this. And I never heard from you. And one day I pick up the paper and it's Marsha Warfield presents, and you got a whole line of women you're emceeing for, and you're doing a tour. And I went, well, on one hand, I'm mad that she didn't, you know, call me when she was here. But on the other hand, I'm so happy she got back and did this. And
you stood me up. There was a couple of years between that. There was some time in between that. Because, and I have to, at that time, my sister was sick and I was her caregiver. In fact, you've opened the door for me to say happy birthday to her. Her birthday is the day we're taping.
Oh,
she passed away 2 years ago, and I get a chance to remember her.
Oh.
But that's why I... But no, when I came to see you, it had to be 2014.
Ask my friends. I talk about it all the time. No,
2014 or 2015, something like that.
Yeah.
And then you went out later.
Marsha,
and we talked on the phone, and we were supposed to do it again.
You disappeared. You ghosted me, and you did this whole thing with women, a night of women, and you were playing all these clubs. And I went, well, she's back. That's
a night of women. No. I started. I my first gig in 2015 or 16 was Kim Whitley called and asked me to do her tribute, and she wanted to honor me, and I didn't understand what she was talking about, and she asked me to come out and do that show, and I ended up doing it, and it's the night I came out as a lesbian that night. But that was after I saw you.
Do you think we should have this fight in front of the kids?
I think so, because I got receipts.
No,
but anyway,
really remember it differently, so let's
anyway.
Let it.
We did work together years ago during
the did Arizona in the round.
Yeah.
And we didn't know who was going to go on first, so we flipped a coin on stage.
And then we went, we rotated every night.
And we didn't have a coin, so we flipped a dollar, and then it took forever because it was floating down really slow. And we went, we didn't know who was going to go on because the dollar was like getting breezed around. We were idiots.
Well. But it worked out really well,
I
think it could still be a wonderful show. So think about it.
It'd be an amazing show. But well, let's not have the fight. Let's not have the fight. No
anyway,
fight.
Anyway, I want to introduce you to my sons, my comedy sons, who are just amazing. I love them. They have their own particular ways. And so as I introduce them, they're going to we're going to play a video that lets you know something about who they are. Let's start with my oldest, the one who looks just like me. We just saw Superman together. He's producing this show. He's working all over, and he's here tonight. Steven, what do you have to gay-splain?
Hello, it's Steven Roberts, and I'm happy to announce I have a new series on the Marshaverse called Gay-splaining. Gay mansplaining, as a matter of fact. Steven Roberts gay mansplains everything to you. I'm really excited about this, and I want to start with my first one, which will kind of start us off on the right foot, and that is, don't call me Steve. Yeah, I'm not a Steve. Do I look like a Steve? No, I'm a Steven. Steve is a surfer. Steve is a lifeguard. Steve is a pro wrestler. Stone Cold Steve Austin, right? Can you imagine? Stone Cold Steven Austin. Let's get him. Right? No, it doesn't work. There are people who have named their dogs Steve. There are dogs that look more like a Steve than me. So don't call me Steve. Please, please, please. Just call me Steven. And if you can't remember that, just think of famous people like Stephen Sondheim, big old gay, Stephen F. Austin, don't know anything about him. I don't know history, that's kind of gay. Stephen Colbert, not gay, but gay friendly. Don't call me Steve.
Okay, Stephen. Thank you for that, and I want you to say hello to my friend and settle this fight, Elaine Boozler.
I am not settling anybody's fight. That is not my pay grade. Not my pay grade. Hi, Elaine.
Hey, I'm glad you're better this week.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, we are all glad you're better this week.
Yeah, pneumonia's not fun.
No.
It was bad, but I'm better now.
Yes,
it's so good to see you.
He actually has color.
Yeah, you know.
He didn't have color for a couple of weeks there.
Oh no!
But
I lost 20 pounds. I lost 20 pounds in, I think, 7 days.
Oh my God! I haven't been able to do that since I was 20.
You know, where can we get some pneumonia?
I was going to say, get that pneumonia anyway.
You know, yeah, but. Before we sign up to the RFK vaccine.
Before all the vaccines are gone from America.
We're such an idiot. Anyway, I want you to meet my youngest son. He's my baby boy, my problem child, and the apple of my eye. And he, too, has something to say. He's going to tell us, I think, where he is and what he's doing. Say hello to Skills Hudson. Skills, this video is playing.
What a famo, what a famo, what a famo. It's like 9 something in the morning here in Vegas. I'm getting me a little cardio in on this guy that lives over in the neighborhood. When he sees me walking, he always offers me to ride his bike. So, I'm using this right now to go run errand up at the store. But you can catch me tomorrow at Jimmy Kimmel's. My residency. I'm back in town, baby, off the road. 11:30, Jimmy Kimmel's Comedy Club is going down. Show those me. Skill.
Okay, thank you, Skills. And I want you to say hello to my friend, too. Say hello to Elaine Boozler.
Hello, Elaine. But why wasn't I invited to the Superman to go see Superman?
I don't know. I wasn't invited.
You oh, weren't. I'm sorry, Elaine. I was trying to say that to mom and them first, but also be respectful and say hi to you first, and then. But hey, Elaine Boozler.
Why wasn't he invited to Superman?
Because it was daddy-daughter night.
Daddy-daughter night?
Uh-huh.
I think you got that a little backwards. But no, were you at the town? Were you here? Weren't you working? He didn't think he was working.
I don't know, because I wasn't even requested to invite, so I don't know how my schedule was looking, because I wasn't even asked.
Anybody ever requested you when we know you're not available? But thank you.
You didn't even give me a chance to even ask, hi, Elaine Boozler.
Hi.
And I was going to say how lovable he is and how much women love him. And the first thing he does is come out and attack me for
it's
I took you to
night.
See.
It's fight night in the Marshaverse.
I took you. All, and you know, what the hell did I do? Anyway, I took you to see Sinners.
But I like Superman. You made me go see Sinners.
Do you know that Superman, because of the dog in Superman, that Google, it's gone up 500% of people looking up how to adopt a dog from a shelter, which makes me the happiest woman in the world because I have run my rescue, Tales of Joy, for 25 years.
All right. Well, tell us all about that because I know about it, but tell the people.
We're a nationwide rescue organization, but we don't go to the pound and take out dogs. There's so many millions of 2 to 5 to 10 people rescue organizations across the country, mostly women, and they do more than the entire bloated BS Humane Society of the United States, who spends their money on trips and salaries and garbage and don't do adoptions or anything else. And these women save more dogs in a year. So we raise money in all kinds of ways. And we call them little guy grants. And we give out money every day to rescues across the country in every city, every state. Now we have partners in Mexico. We paid for 3 surgeries today for dogs that weren't going to make it. There'll be 50 dogs in a kennel and the people running it have run out of food for the month, and we'll, you know, go online and have them sent, 500 pounds of food for a couple of months. We keep the little guys open. We rescue the rescuers, and it's
all right. Let's give a round of applause for that.
Thank you. TAILS, talesofjoy.net, and you could look us up, and it tells you everything we do, and you see every animal we ever help. So you know it's for real, and we're all volunteers, so nobody gets paid. All my money goes to Tales of Joy, and all the money, 100%, goes to the animals.
Well, see, I had a problem with the movie and crypto in the movie because in the cartoons, crypto was more like a Jack Russell or something.
Yes, and here he's
he's a little scruffy, and I'm like, that's not crypto.
How dare they change the dog?
I'm such a fan of the 76 version.
No, I know. It's hard. You can't change the characters like, Bewitched. I'm still traumatized from Bewitched. You know, is it me? Is it him? See, they're all too
Brady
young.
Bunch didn't get you, huh?
They changed the husband in Bewitched. And
they did, because he had back problems.
Well, yeah, but they changed the dad in the Brady Bunch, too. Didn't
they just change people and don't say anything, and that's why we're all crazy now. Because we didn't know what we thought we were nuts, and now we are.
But I kind of wanted to go to bed with one stepfather and wake up with another one. I was hoping that was possible.
Yeah, can we get rid of these guys? But I know.
Stephen, do you have a question that you would like answered?
Well, first I would like to introduce Elaine to my 2 dogs, Hamlet and Egbert.
Are they in the picture?
Yeah, they're right here. There's a Hamlet. Do you see him on the couch?
No.
He's right there.
I see a big head. Oh, he's so cute.
And one here. Yeah.
Oh, he's so cute.
But Ham and Egg. And they're both shelter dogs.
Well, that's great. Green Egg and Hamlet.
We had dogs before that, and we only adopted from this one lady who lived in our small town, And she would go out to people who were hoarding dogs and convince them to give to her. Yeah. And then she would take them to the vet, get them healthy, and then do it. And that's really kind of the way of the world now.
Yeah, it is the way of the world. There's so much rescue going on. Everyone, I mean, it. You know, the pounds don't do their jobs. They're making millions and millions of taxpayer money, and they're not taking it out anymore. It's a terrible situation. California leads the nation in killing animals. You know, 5 to 6 million cats and dogs a year because people won't spay and neuter. And it's the only thing that'll change it. Nothing else will change it. I watch, I have 1,000 dogs and cats across my desk every day that I know are going to die that day. And there's nothing I can do.
That's it's so hard.
Break. I don't even know how we keep going, but, you know, we all keep going. But
we
also like support huge organizations that do things we can't do. We send money to the Sheldrake Trust in Florida for elephants and rhinos and SOS Wildlife Africa and India for dancing bears. And I mean, there's so much in humanity. And we just do the little bit, you know, but you realize it barely matters. It matters to that one animal, but we can't make a dent. The whole paradigm has to change. And you look what people do to each other. So they don't give a shit about animals, you know. Until we get dogs the vote, they're fucked. Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much it.
And even then.
Even then. Well, yeah, then they're really fucked.
Yeah, just really fucked.
That we don't give praise and credit to the people who make a difference.
Okay, I want to say something to both of you really quickly. So,
we appreciate the difference you make in the animals' lives that you touch.
Thank you. Well, it helps people. People say, why don't you care about people? Why do you help animals? And I say, do you not realize every animal we help helps a person and or a family? You know, that dog, the first dog we paid for this morning who had tumors all over her bladder and it was a big surgery. That's a family with kids who thought they were going to see their dog die. And now she's not, you know, now she's not. I mean, it saves children. It saves families. It helps old people. And now, you know, we used to just do organizations, small organizations. Now, all I do is I'm on the computer all day sending food to people who don't have the money to feed their dogs, or I'm giving my credit card to vets across the country to pay for people who take their animals in. I mean, we now do individuals more than organizations because people are so desperate. You know, no one has their jobs anymore. No one can keep their animals. And I think keeping an animal in a home is as valuable as putting an animal in a home. If you can help someone keep his dog, cat, bunny, rat, snake, you know, that's just as valuable. So we do. We feed your
snake,
dog.
I don't know. We're good with the rest.
Rats are good. White rats are adorable.
It's not snake.
Okay, I have to say something. Yes. I want to tell you something, both because I may never get the chance to talk to you two in the same room at the same time again. But when I was a kid in the 80s, becoming a young man, you know, you two were people that I saw daily. Or
that's why he's gay now.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Thank you.
But you were important. You really were. I'm gonna mush you up. I'm sorry. You were important. And when I saw you, and I remember at the end of one of your specials, you talking about Andy. And I heard that as like a 13, 14-year-old. I heard it.
Thank you.
Yeah. And you were talking about in his workshops, and you went to his workshops and all that stuff. I mean, that was... I took that in and I listened to both of you throughout my growing up. And just like Susan and Bob on Sesame Street introduced kids like me in Texas with only white people to diverse ideas and people, you guys did the same thing. And you are part of the reason, and I really mean this sincerely, you're part of the reason I am how I am. And if you so then I'm going to follow it up with one more question. And that is, did you and do you have a huge gay following?
I don't have a gay following. I've always done a very heterosexual act. So I, the gay following was like Kathy Griffin and Paula Poundstone. But I did a boy girl act. So I don't have a gay following, or I'd be still making money and touring all the time.
Well, that's
the tragedy of my life that I don't have that.
Because I look at you as gay following ready.
It's
I
just,
think you have
no,
a bigger
I don't know
gay
why.
Following I, than you know. You I might just, have a bigger gay following.
I don't
than
think
you
I do. I just don't.
I
think
didn't know before I came out or anything that gay people knew who I was. I had no clue.
She had an entire softball team following her.
You know what I said before? I remember material when it's great. I could do your whole act from 1976. Oh, man.
Oh, sometimes I watch it and I go, oh, my goodness.
It's different than white guys. White guys come and go, hey, how you doing? What's up? And black guys just walk around looking, hey, mama, you got a job?
You got a job.
Yeah. And then the other one I loved was that you said, yeah, you know, you can tell on the news they have a code word for young black men. You know, when young white men get arrested, it's four teenagers today were held for toilet papering a house. But you see, you always know when it's a black kid because they go, yes, today a youth was a youth.
Four youths were arrested for singing on the corner.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Youth.
Thank you. I remember mostly nothing.
Really? I'll do that for you. I remember the acts that I love. So
thank you. But I remember, like I said, I remember you being the kind of comedian I wanted to be, and appreciating that you were assertive.
Thank you.
Correct
a misconception that, I'm sorry, go ahead.
But you also, didn't you start the whole self-produced special?
Yeah.
Don't we owe you for that?
Well, you know, I couldn't get a show and I met a guy who knew how to produce and I had a nickel in the bank and we did our thing. And it's a long story and everybody knows it a million times.
Everybody does not know it.
Well, I'll tell it the next time I come back.
Okay.
But I want to correct one thing when you were saying about self-deprecating women and stuff. The one thing I want to correct is comics reflect their audience. So those women, when people go, well, they were so self-deprecating, you know, Joan Rivers and Phyllis Diller. What, Rodney Dangerfield was a superhero? Jackie Vernon, Jackie Gale, Jackie Mason, Jackie. The whole comedy world was self-deprecating. They were reflecting America in the 50s and 60s, where everyone got married, they had their two kids, and they had to go to work every day, and they maybe didn't love their jobs, and it was a hangdog world. They would come out, and it was the hangdog, henpecked husband, totally self-deprecating, reflecting the guys who felt henpecked at home. The women just reflected the women at home. It's not that they chose to be self-deprecating. They literally were representing their audiences. The reason I wasn't, and Richard Lewis wasn't, and you know, Andy Kaufman and Jimmy Walker and you know, Leno and Richard Belzer, it was the first time young people had gotten to stand up. We were 20 years old. We were talking about school and taking tests and how we hated our parents and how hard it was to date or have sex and not know what you're doing. So there was nothing to be self-deprecating about. We were just reflecting the people we were talking to. So I'm, you know, I want people to understand, don't blame the women. They only ever say, oh, the women then were self-deprecating. Look at the men. So were the men. It was a reflection of America. And then it got younger and we were talking about other things which didn't lend themselves to being self-deprecating. That's all.
Okay, I'll give you that. But having not seen yourself reflected in
yes,
the larger picture,
of course,
where you
and
can stand up and stand out and be that courageous, right, was huge.
Oh, believe and me, I paid the price. You know,
we don't want you to take away. I don't want anybody to take away from the magnitude of what you accomplished and what you gave to the stand-up comedy world.
And yes, I was hated by every person in the business. The audience is always 2 years ahead of the business. Every man in the business wanted me dead. You know, all those old, horrible, sexist jerks who couldn't get laid when they were in high school. It's like they just saw I was really cute and pretty and sexy, and they didn't know which end the blood was going to go to, their brains or their dicks. And they hated my guts because they felt like they were going to pass out. Couldn't get on The Tonight Show. Carson hated my guts. They all hated me. I couldn't get anything. I couldn't get a special. All these guys were on their second special for HBO already, and I went up there begging year after year. As I said earlier, I was doing 2.5 hours on the road, and I would go up there and say, I'd like a show, and they'd say, no one wants to see a woman do an hour. I'd say, well, I do 2.5 hours on the road. And when I walk into the clubs following a guy that you gave a special to and I show up, what the owner says, oh, thank God, we're going to make our money back this week. I mean, you have no idea. You don't have to like me. I'm going to make you money. That's all you need to know. I can make you money. I can hit the home runs. That's all. Don't like me. It doesn't matter. The people do. And you'll find that out. And they said, no, for years and years. And I met a guy. You know, sometimes it takes a guy. And he just said, this is ridiculous. You're so good. You know, and he had just finished shooting a couple of movies, Rubin, Friday the 13th. He had a company in New York for filming. He said, I'm going to get the best people in New York. You know, how much money do you have? And I literally had, you know, a bagel and a tuna fish sandwich. And he said, well, let's tell them if they work for deferred pay, you know, when it sells, we'll give them their full pay for like a movie. I said, okay. And they all agreed. They said, oh, it's Elaine Boozler. Yeah, we'll get paid. And I mean, that show was amazing. My friend was Tom Waits. He gave me his music. A Letterman stepped out and did the opening sketch. No one had done an opening ever. They just come out on stage. We did a whole sketch. I had Dr. Ruth. It was her first year of being famous. Letterman, Bill Cosby, sorry. You know, then it was a get. And all these great characters, blah, blah, blah. It was gorgeous. And I took it up there, this gorgeous show. And I had been doing stand-up for 12 years. So every joke was a diamond on a piece of velvet in a jewelry store. You have no idea how great this stuff was. And I went up there and they said, nope. And I came home and my boyfriend said, you always said it was personal. And I said, you were crazy. You're right. It's personal. They hate you. I said, I know. It's unbelievable. So he said, what do you want to do? I said, well, I do want to pay everyone. So I'm going to go back on the road for a year, get the money, pay everyone, and then I'm out. And he said, all right, I'll teach filmmaking or something in San Francisco. That's it. Well, there's a great saying. If someone in TV doesn't like you, wait 5 minutes. 6 months go by, 8 months go by. New guys come in, younger, hipper. They buy the show. That was party of one. It bought me a house in LA, apartment in New York, house in Italy, and it ran for 17 years. It got rent. And they all said, well, we'll buy it. I said, you can rent it, babe. You can license it, but you can't have it.
Well, and every woman doing stand-up, not, and most of the guys, owes you a debt of gratitude and need.
And I owe everyone who came before me, and I'm so glad I got to come up with you.
Yeah, well, we came up together.
We but did.
Now Skills,
can I ask one more question? Can I ask
no, one you have question? To wait your turn. Skills has to have his turn.
Okay.
Because I'm sitting here patiently and listen. So you're going to try to slide in another question? First of all, let me show Elaine my dog, Little Stevie. Little Stevie, come here. I want y'all to...
I'm not sending money over there.
No. No, you need to send money. Steve, send help. Send help. No, for yes.
But I want to...
We see it. We see it.
That's who he is.
Nice.
But what I really wanted to say to you and Mom, that Mom knows this from me, but you women, to the groundbreaking stuff that y'all have done, like just sitting up here listening to almost 80 years of experience, you know, of just comedy, not even just life, just stand up. And then me hearing something when you was talking, because I'm a big fan of Andy Kaufman, right? And before I got into stand-up, and I just knew him from Taxi. So before I got into stand-up, I didn't even know he was a stand-up comic, right? So when I got into stand-up and started doing my research and found out, I even loved him more. So now fast forward and hearing that from you, after I get off the phone, I'm going to your website so I can read that article about, because, you know, I've watched the movies, watched the different stuff, but it's never changed how I felt about him and the geniusness of him. So to hear that you got an article, if I want to go and read that. So, yeah.
12 years together. So, you know, it's a nice piece.
Thank well, you. We didn't talk about another friend of yours.
Well, that's in the book that's coming out, and I won't talk about it. That has to be read because it's a tough one. Another time for that one.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
that's a tough one.
Sorry, guys. I tried. I should have just come right at it.
It's nothing I talk about. It doesn't matter.
Okay.
It's in the book. The book's called Big Fun, and it will come out one day, and it's all there.
All right. Well, there's more layers and...
But you know what they need to know about what you went through? I mean, yes, it was hard being a woman because they hated us. They just wanted us dead. They don't want us talking. What you went through, Marsha, there was a place called Ye Little Club, and that was on the west side. And Marsha and the guys, most of the black comics, they would drive through Beverly Hills from Ye Little Club, have to go through Beverly Hills to get to the Comedy Store. They were always late for their spots because they got stopped in Beverly Hills every night. Every night. Every night they got stopped by the cops in Beverly Hills and had to explain where they came from, where they were going, what they were doing, all the ID. And one night they had Tom Dreesen or some white guy in the car with them, and the cops pulled them over and in this hysteria, "Are you okay, sir? Are you okay?" They thought they kidnapped a white guy for ransom or something. And I mean, this is what they had to come in the club after going through and then go on stage. And like I said, I had no worldly experience. I was an idiot and I just was fighting everyone. So I said to Marsha, "Oh yeah, well, they wouldn't be doing that to me. I wouldn't take that. I'd be yelling at them. You know, I'm just crazy like that." And this is how she taught me my lesson. And I never forgot it. And this is all she had to say. And I understood the world immediately. She just looked me up and down and she said, "Oh yeah, how long you been crazy like that?"
Well, you know, everybody
that's
has
mom.
Their cross.
I got it.
That's
to
mom.
Bear, but it happened every night. We would leave, and usually, if a white comic gave us a ride, we didn't have cars. So if a white comic gave us a ride, it was for certain that we were going to get pulled over when we turned down Doheny onto La Cienega, and as soon as we made that turn, the lights came on, and we got pulled over, and they would pull the driver out and take him to the front of the car, and they would make us sit in the car and then take us out one at a time and take us to the back of the car.
All
and
the time.
Each of us, how do you know these people? With the assumption that the driver was being kidnapped.
I think they would have known you by then. You could have tried your material by the 10th year of that shit. But
one night, these two guys were crawling across the street. They were crawling on their hands and knees. They were so fucked up. They were yelling and crawling. The lights came on. We thought they were getting pulled over. So we went to, they kept speeding until they got behind us.
Oh my
and
God.
And pulled us over. And we're like, "There are two guys.
Look, there's a fire."
Don't pay any attention to that. Get out the car. Get out the car.
Yeah. People don't know what you went through just to go work for free.
Well,
just to be your sense.
You know, that we got stories about.
We got stories. We got stories. We have a lot of stories. We do. We have stories.
But you had a question.
Yes. So I remember back in the day, Elaine, a joke from your set, one of my favorite ones. He's like, "I don't want to give the airlines away, but their initials are TWA.
Not me.
That's you.
What's the joke?
Well, that was the part of the joke that I remembered.
I don't think so.
Really?
It's okay. You know, I get a lot of people.
I think that's you.
A lot of people come up and say, "Oh, my favorite joke on earth is yours." And they tell me the joke and it's not mine. And I used to correct them because I want the person to have their props, but they would get so flustered that now I just say thank you. Because
well, you tell jokes. I'm going to go on with this question anyway. You tell jokes, and especially back then, you told jokes that people copied in one way or another.
Well, I think I was one of the most stolen from comics in the world.
That's my point, because I think that's true about you as well. Any stories about that or any things you learned from that?
No, there's nothing you can do, you know? I mean, it just happens. And you see your stuff show up on sitcoms and comic strips and movies. I mean, Party of One was really a great, you know, special all about, you know, going to being alone and living alone and going to a restaurant. And then, you know, 2 years later, Steve Martin's movie comes out, Lonely Guy. And basically he illustrates the whole special, you know, with acting it out in his movie. And then, you know, Dr. Doolittle. I mean, my thing was, you know, if my dog could talk, throw the ball, throw the ball, throw the ball, throw the ball. You know, then it comes out in the Eddie. I mean, you just watch your stuff go by and you go, well, they liked it. They didn't like me doing it, but they liked it. So there it is, you know, nothing
they
you
didn't
can
give
do.
You writing credits for it either.
They don't give you nothing. But my stuff, you know, eating cake out of the garbage, it's like such a relatable, you know, thank God I didn't take this out to the big can last night. You know, you can, I mean, Sex in the City there, she's eating out of the garbage. You know, what are you going to do? I mean,
people would ask me, what happens? What do you do when somebody's steals one of your jokes, I say you write another one. Because apparently they can't.
But they take everything.
They write another one. You know, I'm not going to miss that joke. That
people
you
say,
so
oh, it's such a compliment. I go, yeah, it's why I fucked your wife. She's so pretty. Such a compliment. Yeah, that was a real compliment that he had sex with your wife. She must be really pretty. That's congratulations. It's not a compliment. It's just lazy people.
Thank you for this lively discussion is waking people up in the midnight hour. It is, I enjoyed the fisticuffs.
We did have our fight. We'll have to continue our fight in another episode.
Even though you're still wrong.
your show.
But thank you so much for staying up. Thank you for all you've done. Thank you for who you are. We didn't talk about comic relief and all the other things we've done.
50 years. We have 50 years to cover.
Yeah.
We'll have to continue.
And I can only remember like 6 months of it.
I'm with you.
So thank you very much. And are you living out of the country?
I go back and forth. I go back and forth to Italy, America and Italy. And here's my sticker you can buy on my website, Not My Felon. And it's all the right. Presidential seal, Not My Felon. And then it's E Pluribus Scrotum, it says, because I coined the word.
E Pluribus Scrotum. Scrotum, all of that. We can talk politics next time.
Next time.
You stay up late.
Look at you.
This is just like staying up when we were younger, hanging out at.
I think we ever saw Panthers before 4 a.m.
Panthers, Ben Franks, the Copper Penny, and all those other places.
Yep.
You know, and only the difference is I didn't bring snacks.
Well, I'll go have snacks when we hang up.
All right. Pleasure thank you so much for being here. And
Elaine, it was so nice to meet you. What a pleasure.
So nice to meet you. And Marsha, I really thought that you ghosted me, so I'm glad you did.
No.
Well, I didn't ghost you, that's for sure. So,
well,
whatever happened, it's unintentional by both of us, because I thought
there was a glitch in the matrix
that's all.
Something happened and life continued on separate tracks for us. But it's great to have this opportunity to get together and talk to you.
And I love you. I'm so happy.
I look forward to doing it again anytime if you feel like breaking your no podcast rule.
Sounds good to me.
You're welcome here.
I will come back and we'll keep fighting. Okay. Okay.
Thank you. All right, honey. Take care.
You
love
too.
You. Bye.
Love you. Bye.
Skills. We need him back.
I was where back. Steven is the worst. You're supposed to brought me right back here.
He I don't know where he went.
Okay. What are you doing?
That is pretty. That's pretty music you're making right there.
Are you okay, honey? Skills?
Yeah, I'm okay.
My baby, you all right? All right. So now, Jeffrey Epstein, tell me something. How are you feeling about that?
You know.
Go ahead.
You know, I'm just over it. We have so many other very, very important things. And this whole Epstein thing is, you know, get the people in trouble who should be in trouble or don't. either, you know, shit or get off the pot. I'm sick of it. Do your job or don't do your job. Let's move on or let's go and fucking solve it. But we're just hanging around like a dangling carrot and it pisses me off.
Dangling carrot is a strange euphemism for this case, but we're going to move on past that.
Thank you.
The thing that gets me is that it has upset his base. Out of all the things, like you said, that there are to worry about, this is the thing that makes you say, maybe we voted for the wrong guy? There's a whole world of fuck-up that he has created that could cost people's lives, let alone their livelihood. Yes. And you're upset because he lied about Epstein. Are you an idiot? Of course he lied about that. He lies about everything. He lied about you, the people who are mad. I mean, everything is a
lie.
And this is what has caused his base to lose faith in him. It just is mind-boggling that that many people, even if it isn't close to half the country, but as many as there are who follow him, to think that there are that many people who are that gullible and willing to die on the hill of their gullibility. It's mind-boggling.
Well, look, so, y'all both know the word habitual, right? He is a habitual liar that is so good at, you know what I'm saying, that his base, that even though that this thing is the, we look at that small thing that's now making his base upset. And we like, hey, not all this other shit that, like you said, that he done. But that's the whole totality of his movement is don't make sense. You know what I'm saying? That people didn't see the movement coming because we all been taught that government and shit gonna run a certain way, and then this motherfucker comes out of basically nowhere and put up on a pedestal, and now all this shit that comes out that's, we been knew that this motherfucker was on the thing. He was convicted of 34, what's the names, before even this Epstein shit. So the shit, on voice saying that he grabbed him up by the pussy. Come on, y'all. So
yes, there are many things that should have canceled him long, long, long ago. He was a joke. He was a response to a punchline. Obama had embarrassed him, so he's putting the country through this for revenge against being a laughingstock, which he's always been. How do
and
you
look booing at him
and see a president? It's just amazing.
And they're booing him at the World Cup.
They're booing him everywhere. He gets booed a lot, and he has been getting booed a lot.
So you know he got booed, so he kept the trophy. He kept the original and told them to make the team a fake one. So he kept the real one. And
and he wants a Nobel Prize.
He's so bogus.
If you tried to write this as a sitcom, nobody would buy it. Nobody.
Yeah, white people.
It's too far-fetched.
It's Green Acres is not as...
White people get away with so much.
Oh, my God.
Well, not all white people.
Yeah, but the thing is, he's
most of them.
People can get away with something. All white people have the ability to get away with something.
I like how you say, yes, that's a better way. Okay. Yeah, ability.
I take it back.
Y'all all have that superpower that some of y'all just don't use it. Steven, you have superpowers.
It's the assumption that you deserve it and nobody else does. Charlie Hill's line was, it's our country. We stole it fair and square. It's that attitude that pervades the whole everything. So, but I think I have a word for the people who are never woke, the never woke people. They must be zombies. because let's call them the zombie party, because they're walking around purposely dead. No, we don't think we woke is bad.
And now we're going to eat you.
It's a strange situation that is hard to put into words. Anyway,
Ma, real quick, off subject. Why do RFK sound like that?
Heron, boo, Heron,
and brainworm.
Yes, Heron.
Heron and brainworm.
You know,
hey, do you know what I had for a snack during your podcast today?
Heron and brainworm.
Peach rings.
Ooh, I don't think they sell those in the hood.
Peach rings. They do. I bought them from the hood because I live in the hood.
I think we used to call those apple candies.
Your nice house is not in the hood.
It is.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is. It's right across from it.
Not.
Yes, it is.
There is a corner of that area that's notorious. There used to be.
Yeah, it's right up the street from us.
Ma, yeah. Ma, tell her where you dropped me off at. Tell her where you dropped me off at, Ma.
There are more than one hoods.
Well, no, this is a different hood. This is a different hood. You live in the white hood.
Hey, no.
I live in the Latino hood.
Stephen live where feral cats at. That is not a you got feral cats in your hood.
Well, it smells like feral cats in the hood.
You got people leaving out food for homeless people in your hood.
Hey,
leave something out there for little Stevie.
Stephen, yes. Where will you be this week? Are you working this week? Are you all better?
Yes, I am all better. Thank you very much. You can catch me on Friday. I have two shows on Friday. On Friday, I'll be at Don't Tell Comedy Show. Look it up, don'ttellcomedy.com, and look up Las Vegas. And then right after that, I'll be at Wise Guys in Town Square at WrestleMania 7, hosting the roast battle there. So join me if you want to watch people cry.
Aww. And I look forward to that. And Skills, my baby boy, where are you going to be this weekend?
This Friday, I'll be at Jimmy Kimmel for my recipe. Show those skills Friday.
Tell me about the anniversary of your Jimmy Kimmel show.
Yay!
Oh, no, that's not to August. It's not to August.
Oh, okay. You coming
Don't
up
jinx it.
In August. August it'll be 2 years. Yeah, it'll be my 2 year anniversary. Knock on wood.
Congratulations.
2 years. Thank you. This Friday, I will be there. Saturday, I'll be in LA for Screw the Rules comedy show at Stand Up in Bellflower. And Sunday, I'll be back in Vegas with Lunel for her residency Sunday and Monday at 10 p.m.
All right.
Jimmy
Kimmel. And I will be here throughout the week posting Midnight in the Marsh verse. Adjacent things, and of course, preparing to do more Midnight in the Marshaverse things. And I am looking forward to having you come back. Please feel free to like, share, comment, send us a note.
Yes.
Tell a friend.
Send us money. We take money.
We need your eyeballs. And we need your participation to help us
What's
grow.
Our Venmo? We need a Venmo
to help
send
us
all the cash
grow.
Send the money to my Cash App, and
we can start doing other things. You know, like these wonderful shirts and stuff like that. But we just want to have a chance to entertain you. So please keep us in mind. And if you missed the webcast, the visual, you can find us. Wherever you get your podcast, Spotify, Apple, Amazon, you can find us on all platforms. You can find us at marshaverse.com and on YouTube. So there's really no excuse for not dropping by and having a little cannabis and cognac and a little fun talking to people who is you know, fun to talk to. Thank you.
Listen to us on your way to work. You'll be in such a good mood.
Listen to us on the way to, or late as you are drifting off to sleep with a smile.
Or right after you have sex.
Or right after you have sex. While you're getting a haircut.
Anytime. Or while you're having sex.
While you're having sex. I don't shame nobody's kink, okay? That's your thing. But.
Okay, peach titty.
Peach titty. What?
He called me peach titty.
Instead of P. Diddy, P. Shitty.
You're the one on the toilet?
Yeah, really.
I don't know. Sometimes I feel like
that joke went over your head. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, it did. You want to explain it? Okay. You got to.
Let's not explain it because I got it. I got it.
I don't. I would have had to have been listening.
Tell my later.
Okay. You have sativa and indica. You have no hybrid.
No, because I make hybrid. Like, you know how yellow and orange make purple? This, if you put these two together,
yellow and orange make purple?
Well, something like that. Some colors make purple.
Yellow and orange don't make
purple. Why would you go back to that? I'm talking about this. You remember it's the color part that I'm...
Okay, so you made purple.
No, I'm making a hybrid because I put them together.
Okay, enjoy. It's been such a blast talking to you both, and I thank you for all the work you've done so far. We've done 50 of these episodes, I think, and we're learning more about how to do them better and take it further. And I thank you for all your help and contributions, and I look forward to doing this again with you anytime. We're going to let the old man on the porch take us out of here and give us our last word. Thank you once again, Elaine Boozler. Thank you for watching. Thank you to my sons. Love y'all. Good night.
Yeah, I'm just out here chilling. Boy, these people done got me so upset. Done passed that big bogus Better Cost bill through Congress. Now, people won't even be able to get their medical card. Huh? Yeah, I get country when I get pissed off. They done made me mad. People got to decide whether they gonna pay their mortgage or get some medicine for their child. And so now they got to sleep outside under a bridge in a cardboard box. That boy, them low-life, black tongue, dirty drawers wearing Yannickers, I can't stand that mess. And then they're going to slide around and say, we're going to give senior citizens a tax break on their Social Security. Don't give me no tax break. Take that money and buy them people some medical care. You understand what I'm saying? Look here, get, let them have it. We got to start thinking about each other, thinking about other people. Don't give me no tax break. Just give me what I paid for. How about that? Huh?
Don't you know that the queen is back? She's back, she's back. She withstands the test of time. When it comes to strength, she comes to mind. Get down, she gets back up again and again. I'm talking about Marsha.